Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Welcome, Dress listeners, to part two of our conversation with Keita Motoji and Mark McNulty of Ginza Motoji, Japan's premier specialty kimono purveyor and a company that, as we learned on Wednesday, comes with a lot of heart. And that is because this company is so dedicated to preserving and celebrating the many makers and age-old processes responsible for the living and breathing art form and practice of kimono.
Today, Keita and Mark are back to take us into the Ginza Motoji shop to share with us the process of purchasing a kimono. So we will also learn about the different types of kimono and the continued significance of kimono in Japan today, especially as it relates to a new generation of wearers, of which Keita and Mark are a part. Keita and Mark, thank you for joining us again.
Welcome back to Dress, Keita and Mark.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for helping us, guys.
Yeah, so on Wednesday, we talked about the process of creating the kimono that you feature at Ginza Motoji from start to finish. And today I want to talk a little bit more about the kimono making and buying process, because so many of us can't just jump on a plane, even though in our fantasy world we would, and come visit Ginza Motoji. For those of us who can just imagine what it would be like to be a customer at your store, I'm hoping you can help us with that. How does a kimono shop work? Because just as the making of the fabric from start to finish is a very special process, so is the turning of that fabric into a kimono. Can you tell us about what that experience would be like for a customer in your store?
Yeah, of course. So I think that's kind of the interesting thing about kimonos. So I think I said briefly before, there's no kimono in their made form in the shop. So what usually happens is a customer comes into the store and then they say, okay, I want a kimono for this event, or I'm looking for this artist, or they come in and they kind of tell us what they want, and then we show them what we have. And then once you can look through all the kimono, then we have the obi as well. So you can choose the obi, and then because they're all bolts of fabric, so you lay them down and take a look at them all. And then you say, okay, I'm thinking this one or this one. And because they're just a bolt of fabric, you can't just like throw it on and like in a changing room, right? So what you do is you come up onto kind of, we have like a little, like a dressing area, I suppose. And then one of the staff will then drape the fabric on you and make the shape of the kimono. When you look in the mirror, it looks like you're wearing the kimono, which is really, really cool. And then by doing that, you can see, sometimes people see you come in like, I love that. And then they try it on, they go, no, I don't want that at all. And then sometimes they're like, I don't really like this one, but then they put it on. When you try something on, it completely changes how it looks. First of all, that's how you kind of try on a kimono as well. And then after that, you have like your kimono accessories, because there's loads of different things that you need. And then what happens is then once you say, okay, let's do it, I'm going to go for this kimono, then our staff will then measure you. And they take all of your measurements, and one specific measurement, which is important, is called a yuki, which is like the arm length, because the kimono is like a T shape. So it's really, really important for your yuki or the sleeve length to be correct. And then, so we take all the measurements and then that's sent off to the tailor. And then all of the tailors that we use are all in Japan. So we send your fabric and then your measurements to the tailor. And then the fabric is, like I said, cut up into just what, 8 pieces to make one kimono. And then all of the excess fabric is tucked away in the seams. And then that's all hand sewn to create the kimono. From the start to finish, it takes about 30, 40 days to make the kimono. And then once it's finished, it comes back to the store. And then once the customer comes back to collect their kimono, it comes like this big paper envelope, which is called like a tatoshi. And it's about 1 meter long. And it's got your big kimonos all folded up inside this washi envelope. And once you open it up, you've got your kimono there laid. And it looks really, really beautiful. It's really exciting when you get a new kimono because it comes in this really nice big envelope. Then the last thing you have to do is just take out the basting threads, and then it's ready to wear. So yeah, that's how kimono works from start to finish.
And this is an inherently sustainable process, as kimono production has always been, because fabric is so valuable, right? And there's no tailoring part. It's using the entire width of the fabric and the entire length of the fabric to create this garment. And you talked about the extra fabric being tucked into the seams. Can you talk about the purpose of that?
Yeah, exactly. So like I said, so the kimono is cut into a few pieces and that's all tailored together. And then all of the excess fabric is hidden within the seams. So the reason for that is that if you decide to give your kimono to somebody else, it can be retailored and a little bit larger, a little bit smaller. Or for example, like my first haori that I got made, which is like a kimono jacket, I wore for 2 or 3 years. And then it finally got a bit raggedy at the end of the sleeve. I sent it back to the tailor. They took it all apart, re-sewed it for me, but then they put the sleeve on back to front. So now that the ragged part was like tucked inside, and then I've got like a perfectly new sleeve. So it looks completely brand new. There's just that whole idea of reuse. And because the kimono is all made sewn by hand with a running stitch, it can be completely deconstructed and reconstructed again. Like I said, so if you wanted to make your sleeves longer or shorter, or you wanted to, you get like kimono from your mother or your grandmother, you can always be retailored to fit you perfectly, which is really, really nice.
And for those of us who are not familiar or have seen the differences in kimono but might not know their significance, can you tell us about the different types of kimonos and the different formalities involved? And it's different by gender too, for men, women, and children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a... Yeah, so there's so many different types of kimono. And I think that's kind of one of the difficulties, I suppose, for many people, is understanding all of these different formalities where the kimono lies. So more or less, though, the shape between men and women is pretty much the same. Just the way that it's worn is different. So one of the main differences between men and women's kimono is that women's kimono are actually a little bit longer. And then when they're worn, there's a thing called an ohashiori, which has to be made. So when you put the kimono on, it's like pooling on the ground for women. And that's pulled up, so it's just reaching your feet or your ankles. And then it's made a big fold in the middle. And then that fold is a historical remnant, right? So traditionally, wealthier women, when they would be at home, they would have their kimono trailing on the ground. And when they go outside, they'd pull it up and hold it in their hand. But then that developed, and then people would tie that. And then that's where the ohashiori comes from. And then another thing as well for women's kimono is the part where the sleeve attaches to the body is smaller than men's, and then this side of the body and then the inside of the sleeve is actually open. And then the reason for that is once, like hundreds of years ago, the obi was way lower for women, but then as the obi started to get worn higher and higher and higher, they had to slit the sleeves and then to make way for the slowly growing side of the obi. So that's one of the main differences between men and women's kimono, like construction wise. And then also usually women, their obi is a lot wider than men, about two or three times the width. And then that usually is made into a big knot in the back called a taiko. And there's loads of different ties as well, but that's one of the main ones.
I'm assuming you work with obi artisans as well.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, most of the, like, it depends on the artisan because, you know, each person is different, but some artists just make obi, some just make kimono, and many make both as well. Yeah. And then I suppose within kimono, it's also different as well for the techniques that are used. So for example, we spoke about kasuri, or like kimono where the fabric is woven to create a pattern, they're usually considered casual. And after that, for example, we spoke about edo komon, that's between casual and formal. And then when you use techniques like yuzen for women, that's usually seen as a more formal technique. So that's usually used in specific kimono called maybe homonki. And then like a homonki is kind of what you would wear to like a more formal or a more dressy event.
Do you talk about the different lengths in sleeve for women?
Yeah, so nowadays in general, kimono, they're usually, the sleeve is about 50 centimeters. I only know the Japanese measurement, so we have to use a different measurement for kimono. So it's called shaku. I only know the Japanese measurement, but yeah, what, 50 centimeters?
Yeah,
so the kimono sleeve in general now is about 50 centimeters. If you're a little bit taller, some people have their sleeves tailored longer. And if you're a little bit shorter, you can have them shorter. But in general, they're about 50 centimeters in length. But traditionally, for younger women or unmarried women, their sleeves would be a lot longer. And then that's something that you can still see today in a type of kimono called kurisode, which is like the most formal kimono that women can wear when they're, you know, unmarried. And then often you see this on Seijinshiki, which is like the coming of age day in Japan, which is every year in January. So when boys and girls, when they turn, what, 20? So it's like the coming of age day. So girls wear these kimono with these like really, really amazing kimono with like really, really fine patterns. And then with the really, really long sleeves. And then traditionally, once a woman would get married, she would have her sleeves cut and then they'd be shorter. But nowadays, I think it's not really like, not about whether you're married or not. It's just once you're kind of in your 20s, you just have shorter sleeves.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Dress listeners, are you not feeling like yourself these days? Do you suspect it might be related to some of the hormonal changes all women experience? Well, then Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows.
So whether you find yourself in menopause, perimenopause, or simply experiencing racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep, and feeling tired all the time, or even a low sex drive, Hormone Harmony is here to get you feeling like yourself again.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
And is there any significance with motifs in particular? Are there any particular motifs that are used to signify anything specific?
I mean, almost every pattern you see in kimono, there's usually some kind of meaning behind it. So there's a pattern called shochikubai, which you can often see on kimonos. So for example, shochikubai means plum, bamboo, and pine tree. So it's these three patterns that you often see together. And then the reason is it's because the plum kind of represents like temporariness. Yeah, so this pattern is seen as like a kind of a pattern of good luck, I suppose. And it's also called like the three friends of winter in English, if you actually look it up. So it's kind of like a really, really good luck pattern. So you can see this on often informal kimono, I suppose, as well. So you might see that on seijinshiki or on formal kimonos. Maybe you might see someone wearing it at a wedding or often even just for kind of dressier kimonos that people might wear at the end of the year for the New Year holidays in Japan as well.
And I'd love if you could talk a little bit about the significance of the family crest, because I know I read an article about Keita that you wore a very special formal kimono for your inauguration as CEO a couple years ago. And there's a fantastic article on your website about that. Can you talk about that kimono and the significance of the family crest?
No, I'm not.
In kimono, there's a thing called mon, so it's like your family crest. And then you can have between one and five crests on your kimono. So if you have one, it's formal. If you've got three, it's a little bit more formal. And then if you've got five, it's very formal. So nowadays, usually you just see one or five. So there's a type of kimono called monthsuki. So it's like kimono with mon, and that's what you wear for formal events. So the most formal kimono for men would be a kuro monthsuki. So it's a black monthsuki kimono. So it's a completely black kimono with five family crests. And then each family has their own family crest, and then that's dyed into the kimono as well. Yeah, so for example, Keita, his family have their own crest, which is Sagari Fuji in Japanese, it's wisteria, which is kind of like falling down. But it's really, really nice because each family has their own crest. I don't have one, so that's what I have to do. When I have to get the formal kimono made, like maybe I could put my Irish family crest in. But it's one of the cool things about kimono is that, you know, you have your own family crest, which is really nice as well.
Yeah, and you can personalize it in that way. Well, you segued right into my next question, which is about the significance and wearing of kimono today, because it is a historic and traditional garment, but as clearly evidenced by Genza Motoji and both of you, it is very much a living practice and garment today. Can you talk about if you wear kimono in your daily lives and kind of about the current state of kimono?
So I think a lot of the time, like when you think of kimono, people think it's just this formal thing. And yeah, of course, people do wear kimono formally, but it's also worn casually as well. I think that's like most of our customers, really. They just like, they wear kimono because they just love wearing kimono. So we sell a huge amount of casual kimono as well. So I think especially during Corona, because people were leaving the house less and less, less people were wearing kimono. And then because of that, less people were wearing kimono. And then a lot of people who used to wear kimono just completely stopped at that stage. So that was a scary time within the industry because people aren't buying kimono. People who make them, you know, people, it's hard for them to continue to make a living. But yeah, since Corona, we're really, really lucky that people have just come back to it again. People just love coming to wear kimono and they go out wearing kimono. And then because of that, we've also noticed that there's also like a lot of younger people who are coming to the kimono as well, which maybe before Corona, we didn't see a huge amount of. But yeah, I think it's just because, you know, in a world where there's so much fast fashion and people are just looking for clothing that just has a little bit more value, in the sense that if you come and you buy a kimono, it literally tells who's woven it, who's dyed it, and then it's sent to a tailor in Japan where it's all done within the country and you can kind of follow the process. And like I said as well, with those things, it can be retailored and there's so many different parts to the kimono. So even if you just get a kimono made, people often just use their obi from their mother and there's kind of like a sharing element of that as well. So I think that's one of the really nice thing about kimono, that it's inherently eco-friendly in that sense, that there's not a huge amount of waste and they can be retailored. And yeah, I think people just are starting to come back to that and seeing the value of it, and that there's not a crazy trend cycle that sometimes we have customers that come in that we say, oh, look, we love your kimono, it looks so nice. And then they're like, oh, this is my mother's, it's like 50 years old. And you just like, you couldn't do that. Your mother's dressed in the 1980s and people would kind of be like, you know what I mean? But that's kind of one of the really cool things about kimono too.
Well, thank you both so much for talking to me. This has really been incredible. And before I sign off with you, do you care to share anything about what the future holds for Genza Motoji or any projects that you're working on that you would like to share?
Yeah, of course. When it comes to like the future of kimono and like what do we kind of plan on doing in Genza Motoji, it's obviously continuing mainly the things that we're doing at the moment. But another thing as well is, you know, since we love natural dyeing as well, Keita was interested to know, for example, so we also do the yanagizome, so like the willow dyeing, but also like if we were to dye with the mud of Ginza, what color would that produce? So that's something that we're looking into at the moment as well, is literally taking the dirt, the soil from Ginza, and then dyeing silk with that and seeing what happens there, which is really, really exciting. And then we went to that building site where these like builders, like it was like 30 meters down the ground, and then they were like excavating to make a new building, and then they like took load the dirt for us, and then we had to bring it to your parents' house. And I think your mom was like, why is there like 50 bags of dirt outside my house? But so like we're gonna like see what we can do with that and see if we can dye anything with that too. But and then as well, so but even within the silk industry itself, it's a lot of older people, and we're talking like 70, 80 years old, and that's a little bit scary, because once these techniques disappear, people stop making this, we're going to lose a lot of these techniques. But even within the industry today, there is younger people, some people who are like, what, in their 30s as well, who are joining the silk industry. And that's really exciting for us, because it just shows that this is an industry that people want to work in. And this is a job that's like exciting to do. And yeah, so I think that's really important to our future as well, is like, you know, to be raising the next generation of people who want to make kimono, who want to wear kimono, and who want to produce kimono in any of the steps along the way, from making the thread to weaving the fabric to tailoring the kimono itself.
Well, and I think you both are evidence of that as well. A new generation preserving all of this art and crafts and the storytelling element of kimono for future generations. So thank you both so much. This has been really special.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Keita, Mark, thank you so much for sharing these incredible insights. This was just an entire world many of us would not usually have access to otherwise. And even if we cannot all wear or afford to wear these kimono, There is so much to learn here about why clothing and its makers matter.
Yes, absolutely. And just one of the many reasons that Genza Motoji is so special. I mean, Keita is really carrying what his father started at Genza Motoji into the future in so many beautiful ways. And we, of course, on Wednesday learned about his collaboration with artists, but he also hosts educational workshops as well as monthly artist talks at the store. I mean, everything they do at Genza Motoji is about celebrating the makers. They are in many ways the beating heart of this company. And really, this dedication to artisan and craft uplift is something that undoubtedly will ensure Genza Motoji's continued success and the art and practice of wearing kimono as well. As the company's website tells us, quote, "We wish to bring joy to the makers and to the customers. We believe by doing this, we can bring kimono into the future with us."
Well, that does it for us today, dress listeners. May you consider stopping to honor the makers of your clothes next time you get dressed. Be sure and check out Genza Motoji's website at motoji, that's motoji.co.jp, and the company's Instagram at Genza_Motoji. You can also follow along on Mark's Instagram at mark.mcn and Keita's Instagram at Keita Motoji. Keita's Instagram is full of the most wonderful videos taking you into various kimono artistic processes, many of which we will share with you on our Instagram this week, which is at dressed_podcast, as always. To find the Instagram content specifically linked to this week's episodes, you can check out the hashtags dress368 and dress369.
Dress listeners, we are still considering adding a second week to our Dress Fashion History Tour of Paris this fall if we have enough interest, and the dates would be October 12th through the 19th. If that sounds of interest to you, please reach out to us at hello@dressedhistory.com to reserve your spot on that list. And dressedhistory.com is, of course, our website where you can find information on our upcoming fashion history tours, classes, anything else we have up our sleeves, including part two of my class, What Women Wore to the Revolution, 100 Plus Years of Transformative Fashion, which is now open for registration. Beginning June 23rd, we will explore the evolution and revolution of women and the clothes they wore in some of the most iconic eras in fashion history, the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I'm also super excited to announce that I've added a free book club component to this course that is included with your registration. And it includes more than one guest, so I really hope that you will join me.
Yes, and of course, if you head over to dressedhistory.com, our website, you can also learn more about my Fashion History Fridays at the Met, and I'm considering expanding those offerings to day tours on Tuesdays. So that is coming up very, very shortly in the next like week or so. Also, remember, you can always find an array of our favorite and podcast-featured fashion history titles on our dress bookshelf through bookshop.org. You will also find a link to our bookshelf in our show notes, as well as a link to sign up for the ad-free version of the podcast, which is just $3 a month. And you can do that by subscribing to the exclusive content version of the show, which is ad-free.
As always, thank you for your continued support. More dress coming your way soon. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media.